Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Our guest today is Don Dobe, and we speak with him about his bestseller, The Remarkable Effect, why your software business isn't as good as it could be, and what you can do about it.
Remarkable software companies acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. So it's about saying no. But it's also about really articulating beyond demographics and firmographics what's characterizing that customer, those customers that will buy it regardless of any objections that they possibly could have because they want it. That are prepared to pay premium. Very often companies, you know, they say, well, who's your ideal customer? Well, it's a customer of 500 to 1,000 people in this industry, in that country, and then it stops. But yeah, of course, that's where you start searching for them, but that's not your ideal customer. There's like maybe 90% of the customers you'll find in that pond will never buy from you for all kinds of reasons. So what is the 10%? And of course, that is a tough thing because that takes guts to say, okay, we're going to focus there.
Don is the founder of Value Inspiration and author of The Remarkable Effect. This thought drives him. Imagine how fast we could solve the world's biggest problems if more SaaS startups would gain traction sooner. Today, 90% fail. His mission is save mission-driven SaaS CEOs from the stress of not enough traction by turning their business into one the world talks about and keeps talking about. Now, on to this insightful discussion with Don Dobe. Don, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted to have you here. This is a long time in the making. I mean, we connected nearly like 6-8 months back when we said that we are going to get you on this podcast, and then somehow, you know, it took so long. But I'm so delighted that you are here.
Same here. And glad, well, I mean, better late than nothing than never, right?
Absolutely. Don, before we actually dive into the book, Remarkable Effect, I would like you to tell me what you are currently doing. What's keeping you busy these days?
What's keeping me busy is to help B2B SaaS founders from around the world solve their challenges around creating traction. That's in a nutshell. I'm running a consultancy, and I've always been working for an enterprise software company myself. And when I left the company in 2017, I decided I didn't want to work for another large company anymore. I wanted to use my expertise and my knowledge to help smaller companies, SaaS companies, startups, scale-ups from around the world, to help them get across the challenges that I've faced in my career. Typically, that's around their inability to stand out in a very dense market. How do you do that? So what I've actually specialized myself in is help crystallize what makes those companies remarkable, hence my book, The Remarkable Effect. Crystallize who's prepared to pay premium for that and why. And then from there, like, do everything with those companies. It's like the full cycle to actually create predictable traction.
Wonderful. This is so critical because, as you know, at least 50% of the new generation SaaS or software businesses will fail.
Exactly.
Obviously, the failure rate is much higher in the VC-funded companies. But even in the bootstrapped, it's still 50-50.
it is not because the founders were less passionate. It's just because they didn't know what they were supposed to do. I mean, they knew the product, they knew sort of the gap. To your point, they possibly are creating a Me Too product with very minor variation, which is exactly the point of the dense market and so on. But a lot of times they really don't have the clarity. And that makes the difference, right?
Yeah, spot on.
You left your enterprise software job in 2017.
Yeah.
And you started a consultancy. When did you publish the book? It's around 2018, 2019, right?
No, that's actually, it was written in 2019. It was published on the 2nd of 2nd, 2020. So a lot of twos.
Right.
I chose a remarkable date.
Nice. Yeah. Absolutely. That's nice. It's memorable as well. So when did you think that a book, maybe it was not called in your head The Remarkable Effect at that point, when did this idea sort of originate in your mind that I need to put together this thought that I have, or this hypothesis, or this idea into a book, which can then help software founders, marketeers, whoever you are talking about?
I was challenged. I started my podcast, the Tech Entrepreneurs on a Mission podcast, on the first of January 2018, and then I did a weekly episode from there. And at some point, about a year after, one of the guests, Suzanne Baas, who's the CEO of a company out in the Netherlands, who was on my podcast, she called me, or we had a conversation, and she said, you should write a book about this. There's so much value in the conversations that you have with B2B SaaS owners that shouldn't go wasted just by having it only in a format of a podcast that you have to listen to, start to finish. So that's where I started thinking. And I mean, everybody that knows me or knew me from the past was, first of all, they knew, most of the time they knew that I wasn't a reader myself, let alone writing a book. But I took the challenge and I started thinking about it, checked a couple of people, got a coach. That's how things took off.
Hmm. So tell me a little more, dig in a little more. So you were doing this podcast. When did you start the podcast?
The podcast was the first week of January 2018, about 3 or 4 months after I started my own company. And the reason why I started the podcast was for research purposes, actually for myself. Because, I mean, when you're working for a large enterprise software company with about 4,000 people, you have all the subscriptions, the Gartner subscriptions, the Forrester subscription, the IDC. You got all colleagues whispering in your ear about what's going on in the market and so on. And suddenly you're on your own. Like, how do you keep up with what's hot, what's the trend, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And I realized, I need to do some research. Why not do it in a fun format that is also delivering some value by interviewing people that are in the midst of it?
Mm.
That's how I started.
Right. And how did you get your first guests?
Reach out. I asked a couple of people, do you have any recommendations for guests? And that's how it started. I also was very picky from the beginning, mm-hmm. because I wanted to interview people that were doing things that inspired me as well. I mean, when I left Unit 4, there was an enterprise resource planning company. So it was all about automation. But the last 2-3 years in that journey, we started to think about scenarios whereby we not only automate things away, but actually, because we were in the people business, the services industries, what can we do with technology that actually augments those people to do things never been done before? And that inspires me. So, I mean, if you look at the list of people that were on the podcast, the majority of them were actually augmentation type software providers from all kind of breeds, in the HR space, in the sales space, in any kind of area, but all about how can we make people deliver more value through technology. That was sort of the summary of it. Yeah.
Right. So one of these conversations sort of came back, the guest came back and said, hey, I really enjoyed this discussion with you. And you know what? You should put this in a book. So So what happened next? So you started thinking about the book. You still don't have the value-driven framework. You're still not there, right?
No. But I started to think about it.
These are thoughts in your head, and you're thinking about them. And you say, okay, let's give it a shot. So what did you do next?
Well, I mean, like I said, I checked a couple of people that had already written a book and asked them how did they do it. And a couple of them came back and said, we had a coach. So here's a recommendation. My coach, Sophie, from the UK, is what I started working with. And we had a conversation about, okay, what do you want people to get from your book when they read it? What do you want them to start doing? What should I have learned? All of those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I started to kind of create the arc of the book. And it needed to be, I mean, like I said, I've always been in product management and product marketing. I've realized over my career how important it is to stand out in a market. So I wanted my book to be about, okay, what separates those software companies that we start talking about and keep talking about from all the others that don't have that never got there or got there, but wasted it again, lost it again. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not writing this book is not about how do you run a software company. It's there's many, many books around that. I didn't want to go and and touch that, but it's about now that you run a company, what can you do different in order to get to the point where actually people, your ideal customers, start talking about you, the market starts talking about you, your competitors even start talking about you.
Mm.
And how do you not only get to that point, but actually how do you also stay there? And right. That is touching upon everything the three critical components of what I see as a software company. It touches the marketing side, it touches the sales side, it touches the R&D side.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I get it. So you engaged with this coach, and how did you start actually structuring the book? How did you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, I started to put things on. I mean, I made a lot of post-it notes. If you see the pictures from then on my desk, hundreds of post-it notes, and I started to group things around until I ended up with about 10 different areas. I mean, it were quotes from people. It was the kind of the topics that we touched upon and so on. So I ended up with when I crunched it down to 10 different traits. And so it's the book is about three different levers.
Mm.
And within those levers, there are 10 different traits to adopt to fill the gap around in order to step up.
Right. So this is a good time to, and before I get into I was about to dive into the book, but before I get there, how long did it take you to do this?
Actually, it was quite quick because what I could grab from, of course, was since the beginning of my own company, I committed myself to write a blog every single week. Okay. And it was either about the marketing angle of it, positioning, segmentation, value proposition type things. It was about sales. How do you do that? How do you get pole position in the sales meeting? How do you win more deals? All of those type of things. And it was about R&D side, product strategy related topics. So I had already a lot of blogs written. And once I knew the structure, it was relatively easy to start taking elements of each blog and position that in that structure. The other thing, of course, I had was approximately 60, 70, mind that, of course, grew during the time that I was working on the book, 60, 70 episodes of my podcast. And I record a podcast, then I create a transcript out of it. It was relatively easy to just say, okay, hey, this is a good quote. This is something that actually illustrates the point that I try to make, not from my own perspective, but from the perspective of someone that actually is in the midst of this. So that's where I took quotes. And before you know it, you already have pretty broad outline of what the book is about and what the content is going to be about.
Right.
Then I started writing, and I did it in about 16 weeks.
Wow.
I committed myself to write 5,000 words per week, about 700 or so words per day. And some days you make it, sometimes you don't. But I mean, that is all. That became easier because I already had a lot of words written for me.
Makes sense. And did you want an independent publisher or did you self-publish? How did you go about doing it?
I'm not sure how it is. Maybe it's a hybrid. I used a company at the end that did the layout and that helped with distribution through the normal distribution network.
Right.
And of course, they're making it available online on all the networks like the Amazons.
Right. Wonderful. Let's dive in. Let's start with the name. Why did you want to call it The Remarkable Effect?
Because if you take the advice in the book, if you take it chapter by chapter and take that to heart and you start closing the gaps on each of the traits, what you will see is that it will you will start to create an effect that is bigger than the sum of its components. The first three chapters are about what I call the value foundation. The second are about the viability of the company, the viability lever. The first is the value lever, viability lever, and the last one is the volume lever. If you do the value lever right, then the others that are following then have more potential. So that will give you a boost, and that just grows, and that, hence the remarkable effect.
Makes sense. So let's talk about the value lever. What is it as a concept, and how do you go about leveraging that?
Well, the value lever at the end is what I call the foundation of the business. It's really spelling out three very important things. It's about the segmentation, positioning, and value proposition. But there's a couple of nuances that I've learned the hard way over time that are critical to grasp. The first chapter is remarkable software companies acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. So it's about saying no. But it's also about really articulating beyond demographics and firmographics what's characterizing that customer. I wrote about it this morning, that where you have buying power or where you have pricing power. Those customers that will buy it regardless of any objections that they possibly could have, because they want it, that they're prepared to pay premium. I mean, there's a lot of, sometimes, very often companies, particularly in the space that I come from, you know, they say, well, who's your ideal customer? Well, it's a customer of 500 people, 500 to 1,000 people in this industry, in that country, and then it stops. But yeah, of course, that's where you start searching for them, but that's not your ideal customer. There's like maybe 90% of the customers you'll find in that pond will never buy from you for all kinds of reasons. So what is the 10%? And of course, that is a tough thing because that takes guts to say, okay, we're going to focus there. Because a lot of people think, yeah, but then I'm minimizing the number of options that I have. Well, the fact that you keep your market very big doesn't mean your options are bigger. Actually, there's a lot more ways going on there. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the remarkable software companies create something valuable and desirable. That's trait number two. The valuable part, sometimes a lot of people get that, although they don't live up to that because they think that when they talk about features, that's about value, which is, of course, not true. But the most important word that is connected to there is that it's desirable. And that is an art in itself. How do you create a software product that is desirable for people? Where they say, yeah, this, I need, we need this. Not even I need this, we want this. I come from the ERP world, finance systems, payroll systems, HR, procurement. Yeah, that these are systems that people need, they don't want it. But how do you make those systems desirable? So that's a thing in itself. And then the last one, the last trait in that value foundation is remarkable software companies aim to be different, not just better. And that's already kind of alluding to your point earlier on that it's not about creating a software product that is just a bit better. You always have to realize that companies have something in place. They have an alternative, whether that's software or not. And to kind of move from there, the thing they know, that they've come accustomed to, that actually is working, to move to something else, needs to be not 10% better, but it needs to be multiple X better. I mean, people talk about 10X, but you have to bridge a lot of things in order for people to say, okay, yeah, go there. And that is about being different, because you cannot get it by just making something that is nicer user interface or just a tiny little bit of more efficiency and so on. So that's what I try to describe in the first three chapters.
Right. So I have a couple of quick questions. One is that when you just described how people describe their ideal customer profile, and then it stops after you have identified the kind of industry, the size of the company, and the geography, and so on. What is it that it should actually be? Especially because when you are early, and this is a discussion I have all the time, I think ICP, while it's supposed to make your life easier, has actually made it extremely complicated, because there is no way for you to say, especially in the early days, that this is really my ICP. I mean, anybody I talk to, they say, oh, go and look at your best customers, and then you can, of course, if I have a lot of customers, I can do that. But what if I'm greenfield and I've just come out with something new in an ERP solution? How do I do that? How do I actually say, okay, I'm going to not look at any of these but this, and this is likely to be my best target market?
Yeah. Obviously. Well, it starts, of course, with the assumption, and that's also where a lot of companies go wrong, that when you create your solution, you do that, first of all, by doing your research and actually talking to potential customers, where you've got the sign that they not only want this, but are actually prepared to pay for this. Because a lot of people say, yeah, I'd like that. That's a good idea. But would you pay for it? Well, no. Or the other way. I mean, actually, two weeks ago, I had a podcast with a founder and said, we got all the signs right. Everybody saw the problem. Everybody was feeling the problem. All the checkbox were touched upon. And then, would you pay for this? Yeah, I would pay for this. Then they asked the question, what would you use it for? Can you give me three scenarios where actually this would be of immediate value to you? And they couldn't mention it. Because they were using this, but that was actually fine. And they were using that, and that was not really a problem. And so assuming that all of that is right, then you should have already a lot of signs about what defines, what characterizes a customer that will buy this, blindfolded. Actually, I'm going through a value foundation or a traction foundation project right now with a customer that has the platform built, but no customers yet. And it's exactly the same type of discussion. And it's like pulling teeth sometimes to get the right type of information out. But that is doable. What I'm looking for always, and I wrote a long form blog about this, like I said, demographics, firmographics, that's the easy part. This is where it will fit. But yeah, that's like a big pond. In my blog, I refer to that as a glass of water. Mm. It's like, how do you say that? It's water, It's nothing. It's not nice. It is what it is.
Yeah.
And what I want people to think about is, okay, what would your ideal cocktail look like? So what ingredients are you going to put into this? Putting it into this nice shaped glass that is going to give a flavor. Customers are saying, oh, can I have this? And that is about understanding, like looking at it beyond demographics, firmographics, and looking into worldviews of customers, psychographics type scenarios. What do people care about? What do they aspire? What are their frustrations? Just name all of those. Because once you start kind of articulating that, what you automatically will do is bring a little bit of the emotion in rather than just the facts. The fact that they are a 500 people company, if I give you two companies of 500 people in the engineering space in India, one will buy from you, one will not. How do you know? And you go inside and you check a couple of people and you look for signs and signals that are going to be about what drives those people. Do they care about speed? Do they care about quality? So the black and white type things. What are they frustrated with? What do they aspire? What do they hope for? All of those type of questions. The more articulate you are around that, then that will give you those ingredients to create that cocktail.
Fair enough. And I also think that in many cases, to take on the example that you just gave, that if you ask the customer, like the podcast you're talking of, that okay, what will you use this for? and they have no answer, a lot of times what I have seen is because people just do not want to move away from the status quo.
Yeah.
People get so comfortable with the status quo. It's not even about the competitor's product. It is just that whatever we are doing, it is working somehow. Even if my conversion rate is 2%, I know at least if I do 100 motions, I'll get 2 converted. I'm okay with that. I mean, even if you're promising me 20 conversions, I'm not sure that it'll happen. And I don't want to mess up my stuff that is working already.
Exactly. And I've seen very extreme examples of that, you know, where you could guarantee that in the first 6 months, the company would save $500,000. And no action. But they would add 5% to the bottom line. No action. So, yeah, like a lot of I forgot the book that's recently been written about this. But a lot of it is not about that they buy the competition, but they buy nothing.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Inaction, and then the inaction has nothing to do with your solution or anything else. It has to do with their own fears, how comfortable they are, that they don't want to make a mistake.
Yeah, and especially like our product is in the sales technology stack space. You know, there is so much of uncertainty in the sales organization. Like I was talking to someone yesterday, and the average tenure of a VP of sales is 18 months. Now, if you have got the top job and you know your life is there for 18 months, what are you going to do?
Exactly.
You'll do exactly what you said. Do nothing. Just let it pass.
Yeah, what's the ROI? I mean, you won't even see the ROI often.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
Remarkable software companies master curiosity. And not only the founders, but they encourage that people are challenging things, keep asking why, keep figuring out like why not, and then stay open for that. And that is something that is hard enough. In the startup phase, everybody is, curiosity is nothing really of a problem. The moment your company grows, there's more risk involved, and the risk gives people fear. Sometimes it's the other way around, that everybody is telling themselves the story of, we're doing fine, we're doing great, aren't we? So you get complacency, you get that type of bias, and complacency is a killer for curiosity.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. So let's move to the viability lever. So we have, once we have created the value or we have defined the value, how does that work?
Yeah. So the foundation is there.
Yeah.
Then the reason why I call it the viability lever is because once you start to create momentum, which is the lever that comes after that, or actually, I mean, you can turn them around. I put them in that order, but how do you stay there? And so trait number 4 is that remarkable software companies master curiosity. And not only the founders, but they encourage that people are challenging things, keep asking why, keep figuring out like why not, and then stay open for that. And that is something that is hard enough, because a lot of time when people, I mean, in the startup phase, everybody is, curiosity is nothing really of a problem. The moment your company grows, there's more risk involved, and the risk gives people fear. Sometimes it's the other way around, that everybody is telling themselves the story of we're doing fine, we're doing great, aren't we? So you get complacency, you get that type of bias. And complacency is a killer for curiosity, because you think you're doing the right job and you don't ask the questions anymore. And that's where companies start to fail. Second thing is the another trait in that block is that remarkable software companies create new value possibilities. And that goes to the point of, no, we're not going to create something that's already out there on the market, make it a little bit better. What can we do to create new value possibilities? Things that haven't been done before. That is also tough and hard. But the moment you get your value foundation right, and you know why you're doing it, and you know what type of business you're really in. To give that example, we always thought when I was in my previous employer that we were in the ERP space. Well, that's the software category. But we were not in the business. Customers didn't see us like that. We were in the business to help them accelerate growth, use change as an advantage to become a leader in their space. That's a completely different type of thing. And we did that magically through an ERP solution. But the moment, so if you define right what business you're really in, and you have the curiosity to look at things with a different pair of eyes, then you will find things that will create new value possibilities. That's where creativity really kicks in and becomes a lot easier. So that's one. Then the third lever in that box is that they create fans, not just customers. A lot of companies think, okay, got a customer, find a new one. Everybody is always focused on new business.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's about make sure that their existing customers don't churn. And a lot of times that is about, okay, keep contact with them. And typically, for a sales perspective, that happens at the end of the year, just before the renewal date.
Yeah.
But that's not how you create fans. So what can you do across the whole business to make someone an ambassador for what you do? And that can be through products, that can be through marketing initiatives, it can be through sales, it can be through customer success. I mean, any company or any department in the business has a contribution to that you can leverage. So that's what I talk about there. Because, and exactly, but that's also kind of connecting to the remarkable effect. You want customers to start doing the work for you. Yeah. They need to have something to talk about that they want to talk about and share with their peers. Have you seen this? You should check this out. Because an ambassador not only buys more, and not only buys more often, but they also bring more peers, people like them. And that, again, if you have figured out your ICP, your ideal customer profile, the people that when you enter the meeting, you're on the same wavelength, conversations go like yes and rather than yes but, and then you find those companies and you turn them into ambassadors, they'll bring people like that as well, because that's who they are connected with and who they are communicating with in a way that they like. That's the third lever in that box. And then the last one is remarkable software companies focus on the essence. And a lot of times people think when they hear they are focused, yeah, but we are focused. We focus on this segment of the market. We have these three products. But focus at the end is often ill-defined or ill-understood. And it starts with, for example, focus on the essence, like what is the real problem we're trying to solve here? And out of my experience, when I, for example, listen to salespeople, 9 out of 10, they haven't got a clue what problem they really are solving. They think, yeah, the customer isn't efficient enough. Well, that's not a problem. That is how you fix it. But the problem, what wakes them up at night, is a completely different thing. And once you, if you don't understand, if you don't like move on from an R&D perspective already on like what is the essence here, what is really keeping a customer up at night, you cannot solve it either. You just create another user interface. And you just move around a couple of boxes. But these are four that are really key, and working together again will allow you to start the momentum and then keep that momentum, because the market is dynamic. If you've what has happened in the last 3 years. I mean, I can't even put it on a one pager. COVID has happened. Economic crisis happened. The climate change just continues to grow. There's a war going on. I mean, and these are just the four big ones that everybody knows, but there are so many micro type of challenges. All of these things change how the dynamics of your customers are living in, and that changes what goals they set, what priorities they make. And the moment that you think, okay, we are perfectly fit for this customer, the next moment you're not anymore. You need to be on top of that, and you want that you solve that in that viability lever part, because it allows you to, first of all, be laser focused on the right type of customers and not waste time on the wrong ones. And I can have a long debate around that. But once you do that, you can start to kind of make those customers that where you're already the perfect fit, make that even better, but also start working on the things that will come next. And what I've seen a lot of times is that the momentum starts and then it drops and then it falls because complacency had kicked in. They didn't like move with the next big thing that the customers needed. And then it's too late.
Yeah.
Because revenue kicks in or starts to drop. Then you have to align cost with revenue in order to have a reasonable margin. Therefore, you have less people. I mean, what are they going to develop for you? Now it's really the heat is on to build something that is the next stage again, and you haven't got the people for it. All these things, I mean, talking about the numbers that you shared, the 90% of startups, the 75% of scale-ups, particularly venture-backed indeed, and then the 50-50 on the bootstraps. That's where the failures lie.
Absolutely. Makes sense. Let's move on to the last lever, the volume lever.
Exactly.
What sort of, I guess this is about scaling and becoming big and also retaining the essence of the previous stages, right?
Exactly. True.
You know, that's one thing that gets lost. Like you said, you become big, you become complacent, you become big. I mean, there are n number of things. Then suddenly the core KPIs change and you're suddenly doing things for the market or you're doing something for your investors, but you have moved away from focusing on your customer and so on. And we see that repeating over and over and over again.
Yeah, exactly.
With very, very large, very successful, very smart companies. I don't even want to go into that discussion of, the books, the companies listed in Search of Excellence, the book, how many of them are in the top 50 still? And you'll find maybe three of them.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it is indeed about scaling, but I wanted to kind of focus particularly on momentum creation. Because scale is a different set of books. That's about, you got momentum, the fires are going, and now you throw extra oil on it for them to grow further. Like, scaling is absolutely a critical thing, but the last three chapters of my book are not about the scaling side of it, but about creating momentum and keep that momentum going.
Mm.
So there's one chapter that I mastered in creating momentum, and there's a lot of examples in there from the podcast and from my own experience about how to do that. The chapter that I really like is the trait number 9 is that they sell the idea, not the product.
Mm.
And that is about selling the outcome. And we forget that a lot. If I go to any website, I see, talking Simon Sinek language here, a lot of companies are excellent in talking about what they do, but they completely ignore why people should care. And if you look at the founder story, sometimes it's also hidden in a very, let's call it inside out type of thinking. We wanted to create a company that's going to be a leader here, a leader in AI. Like, who cares? So, I mean, I always try to get with my customers, get them back to the point, okay, what is the change that you try to create in the world or in your industry? What is the change that even if you were not part of it or even creating it, that you would still like to happen? You know, because that's where passion kicks in as well.
Mm.
But the beauty of what it does is that it's coming from an outside-in perspective, something that a customer loves as well, and they want to be part of it. And that's where movements can be created. And talking about creating a movement, that's where momentum is a really big thing. So I'm a big fan of narrative design, talking about, you know, kind of really spelling out what's going on in the market, what's the undeniable change, how do companies get stuck, and then offering them the new game. And I mean, companies like HubSpot have done that fantastically, and Drift and Gainsight. There's plenty of examples around that. But it's about selling the idea, you know, selling the new game. And that is a fantastic way to start demand creation rather than just capturing demand from the market. Because that is also what remarkable companies really, really do well. They create demand. They inspire people. They sell the idea, not the product. And the product will, of course, always have a place. It's not that you always, let me explain you the idea. People get hooked to the idea, and then they want to know, okay, how do you do this? Okay, glad you ask. Here's how we do it. And then the last one is, and that's also a critical one, very often forgotten, remarkable software companies surprise and hit the right nerve. My world is B2B software, B2B SaaS. And a lot of times people think, okay, it's about B2B, it's business, it needs to be factual. Yes, of course. It needs to be serious. Yes, of course. But at the end, we're dealing with people.
Mm.
And if you want to hit the right nerve, you have to communicate in a way where people say, okay, you get me. This is exactly what I'm going through every single day. This wakes me up at night. They might not say it in those type of words, but that's what I think. So that's about bringing in the emotional aspect of it, because people, you know, they buy with their head, but they think they buy with their head, but they buy with their heart. Even the CFO, who's all about numbers, even about a controller, even about an auditor, even about someone that runs a legal department, they're all people. And they have frustrations, they have anxieties, they have hopes, they care about status. So hitting the right nerve is really understanding and kind of getting under the skin of your ideal customer, living days in their world yourself. And that's hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see it. I mean, one question I have here, and maybe with that we can wrap this up. The buyer, by the time he's coming to you, he has crossed a lot of distance to come and start talking to somebody who is going to provide a solution.
Yeah.
Right? They would have discovered that something is needed. Then they would have tried to solve it internally. Okay, what softwares and what do we have? Can we use that? Or what expertise do we have? Can we solve it with that? And then eventually they do some research, and then they identify prospective vendors. And I'm not really talking of a $1,000 per year kind of SaaS. I'm talking of something more substantive, like what you are selling, right? Like enterprise level, anything between $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year. A lot of water has flown under the bridge by that time, right?
Yeah.
How do you start engaging early? Is there anything that you touch upon in your book?
Yeah, well, that is, again, it's almost starting with chapter 10. But in order to do chapter 10 right, you have to do chapter 1 right. You know,
right.
Because if you articulate who you're for and who you're not for, these are two very important things. Because a lot of people know who they're for, but if you ask them, okay, but who not? Yeah, they go outside of their industry. Well, not that industry, not that industry. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the same industry, the same size, same number of people, same number of revenue. And like, what defines your customers that are not ideal for you? But the moment you understand that, kind of hitting the right nerve, it becomes relatively easy. I mean, the only way to get the eyeballs is to be out there, and that starts with content creation.
Yeah,
write that blog, and write it from a perspective of your customer, and outline the top 20 problems that wake them up at night. Talk about that. And how do you solve that? Mm-hmm. That's how things are created. Use leverage narrative design. We talk about the old game and the new game. But again, that all ties to clarity about the problems that that your customers want to solve. In my book, I give a page number 24. I talk about the triangle. And Jonathan Stark, I was on his podcast a while ago. He actually talked about, he started referring to it as the broken triangle, which is, I think, a nice way to look at it. But you want a triangle to be equally sided. And the moment one of the sides is off, you know, that is broken. And this is about three things. So what I recommend my customers always to do is to create a list of all the problems that they think wakes their customer up at night. Make a list of 10, 20, 30, 40. Then for each of the problems, answer three critical questions. That's where the triangle comes in. On a scale of 1 to 10, how valuable is this problem to solve? And give it a number. On a scale of 1 to 10, how valuable is that problem to solve? And give it a number. Just go through the whole list. Then you go to the next column and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how critical or how urgent is this problem to solve? And that becomes a formula. Because when you multiply value with urgency or criticality, you get a number between 0 and 100. And if you then use the spreadsheet technology to just sort it, suddenly you got the top 20 or the top 10 available. That's where the question number three comes in. Looking at all those problems again, on a scale of 1 to 10, on which of those problems can you exceed expectations? Because companies don't buy when you solve their problem, they buy how you solve their problem like no one else in the market. That's where difference comes in. And not difference in terms of how you are different from one that competitor or that competitor, how you help them make the biggest possible difference. Mm-hmm. Always looking at it from a customer perspective. And then when you multiply that with the other outcome, then you get value multiplied by criticality, multiplied by exceeding expectations, and you get a number between 0 and 1,000. I guarantee you, if you focus on the ones beyond 500 points, you got a pretty good list to start positioning your company.
Yeah, I see that. This is a great answer. I think there's a lot for people to take away. On the point of takeaway, if you want people to take away one thought from this book, I know it's always difficult. It's good for the interviewer to ask such a question, but never a good answer. but still, if you do want to point to one, or if you believe that there is one lesson for people to take away from this book, what would that be?
Stop trying to be better. Start being different. Because when you start to be different, you'll stand out in the market and you become a remarkable business.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Don, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed this.
Same here.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. And give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.